welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jacob Kanzler and John Roerink. A little later, Gary Nayert, the executive director of the Great Lakes Education Project, otherwise known as GLEP, will be joining us in studio. But guys, a couple things that I want to touch on here this morning. First off, Governor Snyder is going to be having a bill in front of him that would essentially close the door on the chances of the anti-fracking campaign and the legalized marijuana people to use old signatures to get their petitions in front of the legislature and then ultimately in front of the voters. I think the consensus is, Jacob, he would probably sign this bill into law.
Yeah, I mean, if we've seen how the governor has gone along with some of the other election reforms that Republicans have pushed through the legislature, I wouldn't see a reason he wouldn't to, given his past history on that.
I know that the marijuana legalization folks are really hoping that the governor sees the light on this, but I don't know if he necessarily sees these kind of issues in a vacuum, John. I think there are other pressures involved and maybe pissing off the people who have pushed for this change in the first place wouldn't be very receptive to a veto.
I think he's got enough other legislative fish to fry, if you will, that he's going to sign this and he's going to get it out of the way and he's going to get it done. I don't think he cares enough about the issue to do it. And it does open up a number of questions about what happens with fracking, what happens with the marijuana proposal. And I'm not sure that you need to clutter the plate right now.
And I think that the at least the marijuana folks are going to take this to court. I think they've all along seen this as an issue that they're going to have to win in court as opposed to policy. This will just create an additional barrier here, Jacob, because now they're going to have to argue now that they've created a new law that they have retroactively applied essentially to their particular campaign. It's just another legal hurdle now that they're going to have to climb over.
Yeah, and there's been a variety of legal arguments put forth by the marijuana campaign and also the anti-fracking campaign have both been putting forth legal arguments as to why they're right and what the legislature and what the state has required is wrong. So it'll be interesting to see what a judge says about some of these, because they've gone so far to say if this bill were signed into law, it is unconstitutional. And they've also argued that previous policy is unconstitutional or not legal. So it'll be interesting to see how these arguments play out in front of an actual judge.
And that's where I think that this is going to go. And they're going to have to kind of fast track this, right? Because if they want to get this on the ballot for November, I mean, just getting this through the normal process, John, usually takes a couple of years. They don't have a couple of years. They've got a couple of months.
No, they got to hope that they can make an emergency appeal and that something would happen fairly quickly.
So we'll keep an eye on that and keep our readers informed if they're able to move forward with this and get their marijuana legalization and then whatever other ballot proposals are out there, anti-fracking being one of them, if they can also rejuvenate those old signatures, get them used, and get them on the ballot. Now, a piece of news that we saw this morning from the Detroit News, Governor Snyder has kind of changed course here and used one of his secret funds to pay the lawyer bills on the Flint water crisis. He's using this Moving Michigan Forward Fund?
Making government accountable.
Making government accountable.
The interesting thing is that this was reported to be funds that were given to the governor when there was talk of his being a presidential candidate. And then he was obviously his fate and his fortunes have changed a lot in the course of a year. I find it fascinating that he was now using that to fund some of the legal help he needed for the congressional testimony.
So before we get too far into all the different funds that he has here, isn't it kind of interesting that he was using state government money to defend himself in his role as governor, but then in using the private funds, as critics have asked him to do, he's opened up another thread of controversy by not releasing the donors to that fund? I mean, this game has been played before, hasn't it?
Well, this game has been played before. We all would like to know who gave for lots of different reasons. But, you know, in the end analysis, these debates always are kind of meaningless because what has transpired is legal, first of all, unless you change the law to say, oh, well, you're not exposing the donors. You don't have to expose the donors. So we need to be clear when we're talking about that. We're not accusing the governor of necessarily breaking the law. I don't think he's broken the law. Would it be nice if he exposed and listed the donors to these funds? Sure, but I just, you know, I want to make sure that we're clear that this is not necessarily an illegal thing.
No, but what I'm saying is that in ending one controversy, he just creates another.
He does. Yeah, he did. Absolutely.
And so in this case, Jacob, we're talking about moving around some funds because he does have one fund that was created as the son of the Nerd Fund, which was supposed to be transparent. But he's not using that fund.
The second fund was supposed to be transparent, right?
Right, because the Nerd Fund was not. So he created this second fund, the son of Nerd, to be transparent.
Right. So just to hopefully people can track this visually here. So the son of the Nerd Fund was moving Michigan forward. And the pledge was that we are going to show who donates to moving Michigan forward. And they've done that quarterly. But some of the donors to moving Michigan forward, one of them is Making Government Accountable, which is, again, a nonprofit, an organization. So then you go a step further. Who is Making Government Accountable? Well, it's a nonprofit that doesn't have to list who donates to them. So, yes, and that's according to law, and they're allowed to do that. So when you say the governor is listing his donors, he did. One of his donors is a nonprofit that doesn't have to list the donors.
In the governor's defense, in the article, I believe, was, we're not releasing these because these people contributed under the knowledge that their names wouldn't be released, right?
That's 100% correct. But I guess it's up for people to decide when the governor says, I'm going to release the donors. This is the reality of what it looks like in this situation. One of the donors is a nonprofit that is, by law and in all their rights, not allowed to release the individual donors.
And now we've got a third fund in here, right? This is the fund that was created to help him in his exploratory committee for president, right? So we have, what is it, the governor's club?
Yeah, well, and just to clarify, what you just described is Making Government Accountable. It's that nonprofit that was working on the presidential thing. The other organization that we're talking about here is the Governor's Club, which is a 527 Political Action Committee. Again, another organization that can show its donors. Again, one of its donors is Making Government Accountable, according to this article. So as you can see, if you're thinking about it in your mind, you have Making Government Accountable is like a source of money for two other funds that do show their donors.
So he can still hide, if you still want to give to the governor and you don't want your name attached to it, then there's a particular fund you can give to, so you can do that.
Yeah, if you want a how-to, you make an anonymous contribution to Making Government Accountable, and then that money might end up, either paying the legal bills directly out of that or going to one of these two other funds we just mentioned, the Moving Michigan Forward or the Governor's Club.
So what is the lesson to be learned here? I mean, is there a lesson? I mean,
There's always a way to move money around if you look hard enough.
Is that the way it should be, though?
And no matter if you're the governor, in this kind of situation, obviously, that he has with Flynn, no matter what you do, you're going to get flack.
Unless you release everything. But nobody has to release everything, right? I mean, it would just have to be voluntary on his point.
But remember, he may have taken money to the one fund that is federally protected for as far as disclosure under the condition that he not release the result or who it's from.
Yeah, and that's allowed under law. I mean, it's a nonprofit. It's how it works. So I guess, that's up for people to decide. I mean, maybe if you're worried about transparency, change who you can accept contributions from or require disclosure of everybody. But, that's up for other people to decide and how transparent they want to go. And, there would obviously be some people opposed to measures like that.
It seems like we're just behind on the disclosure end of things, doesn't it? I mean, just when you would think that we would be able to track something, you can't really track it unless somebody voluntarily decides they want to do that, and they want to voluntarily give up their donors.
It seems like one way or the other, just based on how our system is set up, there is a way to disclose your identity and influence politically, it seems to be.
Well, let's move on to another section of the podcast here. We'll talk about the DPS issue. Joining us now for the podcast is the Executive Director for the Great Lakes Education Project, otherwise known as GLEP, Gary Nairt. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, Gary.
Thanks for allowing me to be here.
Okay, so the public schools for Detroit is back on the agenda this week for the legislature. The most controversial item of this package is this Detroit Education Commission, which would be charged with making sure that the opening and closing of schools in the city is done in a more orderly and structured manner so that kids in various neighborhoods can get to their school without taking numerous buses or having to get rides or what have you. What is wrong with creating this type of a public body?
Well, I would say there are three critical issues that are separating the House and Senate on the DPS legislation, and the existence of the DEC is one of those three. It's the one that we are the most concerned about. in terms of protecting school choice. But the DEC is really set up statutorily, and its goal and its desire is to prop up the new traditional public school district in Detroit, DPS 2.0, DPS Mini-Me, or the Detroit Community Schools, and it's meant to protect them from school choice so that they can keep kids trapped in that urban system and keep that system afloat. That's the number one priority of the DEC. Everybody has admitted it. If you read the Senate language, it's very clear that that's what it's there for. And it's people who want to save DPS as an adult institution, and it has little to do with providing good quality education options for kids. So we're focused on keeping innovation and options and opportunities available for kids, and that's the reason we oppose the DEC. Now, in terms of order and so forth, in no other area of the state is a local government entity approving the location of school buildings. It's just unheard of in Michigan.
But we've got unlimited choice, though, in the city of Detroit, and it sounds like it may be needed.
Well, we currently have unlimited choice and opportunities everywhere in the state, and we're not looking to treat Detroit any differently in terms of the DEC than we are any other part of the state. And every issue in this bill, be it accountability, be it governance, we don't want to treat Detroit differently than the rest of the state, which is what we're hearing from most of the Detroit legislative delegation, too, not to treat Detroit differently than the rest of the state, not to treat them better, not to treat them worse, to treat them the same and make it even-handed.
Now, how many charter schools are in the city of Detroit?
Roughly 100. No, in the city?
Isn't that enough? I mean, if you're going through this major financial restructuring, this district, obviously you know the history of it, isn't it sound to take a pause, to make a break, to hold things steady while we restructure this district? I mean, it's the largest district in the state.
Well, it is the largest district, and it's going to continue to be the largest traditional district as long as it stays afloat. But you're looking at a district that's gone from 180,000 students down to 46,000 students, and the district has been trying to right size itself, the traditional district, because students have left both for charters but also for traditional schools, public schools, and other suburbs. And people have really left the state or left the city, the population of the city. It was shocking to learn last week that Detroit is now, for the first time since 1850, not one of the top 20 cities in the country in terms of population. So there's been a serious decline in Detroit, and the DPS system is trying to keep up. They just have not right-sized fast enough. Now, they claim that the enrollment, and it has, the enrollment decline has started to level off. We're no longer seeing double-digit percentage-wise reductions in enrollment. But there are still charter public schools with waiting lists, and there is still more demand than there is supply for quality school options in Detroit. And I think we haven't seen a dearth of new charter schools in the last couple of years in Detroit because there hasn't been the need. What we want to do is make sure that we don't have what is an effective 10-year ban on a new charter school operator coming into Detroit, and that's what this bill would do.
With respect to the DEC, as I remember, the original intent of it was also to provide a set of academic standards for all schools in the city, not just DPS and not just charters, but all of the above. What is wrong with that?
Well, there's nothing wrong with having academic standards. I mean, we have a state accountability system today that is meant to take care of and reward high-performing schools, but also intervene in poor-performing schools. The problem isn't that we don't have an accountability system. The problem is that under current law, in a city with an emergency manager, the state is barred from intervening in poor-performing schools. So because you have the EM, who's appointed by the governor, he's the sheriff, he's supposed to be responsible for financial decisions and academic decisions, so you wouldn't mix that with having the state reform office engage in poor-performing schools. The difficulty of that setup is that the five emergency managers in Detroit have all been more focused on the financial side of the equation, and they have not been equally focused on the academic side of the equation. So we have a dearth, we really have a high number of academically failing schools in Detroit that have not been addressed. And so under this legislation, without an emergency manager in Detroit, the state reform office will, for the first time, be able to intervene in schools in Detroit. And that will be very helpful. If you look right now, there are 24 schools in Detroit that have been in the bottom 5% list for the last three consecutive years. Of all 24 of those schools, none of them are university-authorized charter public schools. They are all DPS schools, EAA schools, or local charters that are authorized locally. So the state reform office needs to go in there and do their job and attack the worst of the worst. And when we close those underperforming schools, that will help right-size the marketplace in Detroit.
Another question in terms of the choice landscape in Detroit. Would you concede that when a charter school opens and draws students away from DPS, that is a detriment to DPS because they are losing funding that directly affects their operations?
Yeah, I mean, since 1993, the state has decided that we're going to fund children, not districts. So our education system is set up for the funding to follow the child to the school of their choice. So when a parent makes a decision to move their child from one public school to another, we look at that as empowering for parents, it's empowering for students, and the money follows that student. Now, if a school district loses enrollment because they are not meeting the needs of their students, we don't consider that the solution to that should be to penalize parents and penalize students and not allow choice. Choice is what we have lived with for the last 20-something years, and we think that's the first and most important priority in public education.
If I could get back to the actual package on the DEC, my reading of it is that if a charter school is getting A's and B's on this assessment, you can go ahead and duplicate that model, and it wouldn't have to get the okay of the DEC. So what's wrong with it then? If the schools are good, you just replicate them. You don't have to deal with the DEC.
Well, I think it's safe to read the language of the Senate bill and the timeline with which they would have to introduce a new accountability system. And it's very clear that the accountability system that they would be using in Detroit would be the current system used by Excellent Schools Detroit for their report card, based on the people that are involved, based on the language in the Senate bill and the short timeline with which they have to implement one. So I can't see online the entire Excellent Schools Detroit report card for Detroit. But the president of Skillman, Dan Varner, or the executive director, Dan Varner, said in a recent radio interview that under the Excellent Schools Detroit report card, there are probably 6 charter schools that have earned an A or B grade. So it's very clear to us that if that's the yardstick by which schools will be measured, that there are only 6 schools that Excellent Schools Detroit believes are high performing. And we don't know that each of them wants to open another school. So when we say it's the end of a new operator, I mean, you can't open without permission unless you are an existing school that wants to replicate, that has earned that A or B grade. And I think they're going to set the rules so stringently that you're going to see, you'll be able to count on one hand the number of charters that will be able to replicate. So it's a near ban on charters. It's not a total ban on charters. There will be a few that sneak through, even despite the efforts of the Excellent Schools Detroit folks to make that not the case.
So what if we created a DEC then that would have a charter representative on it, or two? Let's say they wrote into law, okay, well, but let's say they say it has to be, the governor has to choose 3, or the charter community has to offer 3, and then the mayor or someone has to pick somebody of those 3. I mean, you'd have representation.
Sure. There have been dozens of drafts of this legislation, and in earlier drafts, the governor was going to propose and name the majority of members of the DEC, and the mayor would name a few. That has since become that the mayor names them all. So the governor has no role in the DEC. It's all just the mayor. In an earlier draft, the charter school representatives to the DEC were proposed by the charter community, by the charter association. That would be more acceptable than the current language, which just says the mayor can appoint anyone he wants from his Christmas card list as long as they happen to be a parent or a grandparent or a neighbor or have some affiliation with a charter school, like they've heard of them. So we don't really think, I mean, you're really just going to appoint people who are there to do the mayor's bidding, and the mayor's bidding will be largely influenced by the political interests in Detroit, and you should read that as the teachers' union in Detroit. That's who will be driving the bus.
So is there any DEC model that you think you could support?
I don't think there's any model that we could support. We've been presented many different ideas. I think the legislature is debating it. The House has gotten it right. The Senate bill that was introduced by Senator Hansen after a year of research had no DEC in it. We think that that was the right approach when it was introduced in January. We think that they need to focus more on the financial difference between the House and the Senate. which is the second issue that divides them, and also need to focus on this laundry list of what we'll call various reforms that the House included in their bill that the Senate did not include that are very divisive that need to be addressed. Those are the three big differences.
So they couldn't make a DEC that you could support. What if they make it all five members charter schools? What if you guys got to pick all five members?
Well, we would still then say it's additional bureaucracy that is unneeded. You don't need the new district under the control of the new elected board, but also under the control of the Financial Review Commission, also under the control of the DEC. That's not going to create more efficiency and more accountability. It's going to create finger pointing, and it's going to create, no one's really going to be in charge. Well, except the mayor, of course.
What do you see the timing being like for this legislation, Gary?
Well, the legislation calls for the new district to be run by the elected school board, and that election now cannot happen in August, so it'll be a future election. The other date that makes this important now is really July 1, which is the first day of the new fiscal year. The current DPS does not really have much money to work with in July and August because they've pledged that all to debt relief. And so the new district, when it takes over, really doesn't get any new funding until late October when their first school aid payment comes. So we really, it would seem best to have a resolution of this by July 1st because it puts the financing in place so that the new district has the funds it needs to function and pay the janitors and run summer school and open the doors after Labor Day. So July 1st would be the best effective date for this to occur.
If that doesn't happen, and this becomes the summer issue that kind of drags into August, what happens? What do you think happens to the district?
Well, I think it's clear that the district runs out of cash and can't pay its existing bills, but it really then can't pay, it doesn't have a method to pay for the summer school that needs to happen for a lot of schools. It can't pay its bills in the summer. They can't borrow against the future school aid because they've already borrowed that. I mean, it's a very dire situation for DPS if this is not resolved by July 1st. It's going to be a very chaotic and uncertain summer.
Gary Nair from the Great Lakes Education Project, otherwise known as GLEP. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Gary Nair for stopping by, Jacob Kanzler, and John Rurink. You know, Gary had a beard. Jacob's got a beard. John, where did your beard go? I saw you last week. You had a beard. You have no beard no more.
It was sacrificed to the itchiness.
The itchiness?
Yes. I was away this weekend and forgot my razor. And by the time I got home, my neck was so itchy, I started cleaning it up and I just didn't stop.
Before you knew it, it was all gone?
Before I knew it, it was all gone.
Couldn't you have done something different, though? I mean, maybe you just shaved your neck and just leave the face part.
No, the beard will be back at some point this year. I don't know how soon, but...
September?
It might be September.
Yeah, when it gets cold out? Yeah. See, I just thought it was a spring thing. You know, I haul out my salmon-colored jacket, and you shave your face.
Absolutely.
Yeah, our intern has a beard. You know, we don't want to be shown up by the intern here.
That's right. Yeah.
Getting shown up by the 20. See, this is about as far as I can go on my beard. You can't see this on the podcast, but it's about a 3-day growth, and after that,
you can't take it anymore, can you?
No. How many times have I touched my face during this podcast? Yeah. You can't see that either, but it's been multiple times.
Yeah.
And then the next time I touch it, it'll be with a razor.
Yep. I just started trimming. I thought, what the heck? It's been a while. It's been about a year, 2 years.
I can't wait to find out what music I'm going to pick to go with this here. Is there a good beard song?
No, it's on the head. You're going to find it.
ZZ Top.
That's the answer.
Till next week, I'm Kyle Mullen. Take care.